This is Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. There was a piece in The Atlantic which was headlined, "Vaccine Refusers Don't Get to Dictate Terms Anymore." I thought that was a rather assertive statement, so we've called up the author, Julia Kayyem, who chairs the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, was also in the Homeland Security Department in the Obama administration, has also written a book called Security Mom, An Unclassified Guide to Protecting Our Homeland and Your Home, which I should also ask you about. But it sounds like you're among those who's just out of patience with the unvaccinated. So answer their argument, which is that this should be a choice, and to force us to get vaccinated is an assault on our freedom.
Right. And no one's forcing you. I mean, this is my answer back. The idea that choice only is held by one group of people is both self-centered and not accurate. We all have choices. There's a majority of eligible Americans, now close to 75%, have gotten one or two shots. That is their choice. As a reflection of that choice, many institutions are now imposing privileges and burdens based on vaccination. That's all it is. It is you get the privilege of going on a cruise line or playing in an NFL team. And no one's grabbing you off the corner and sticking a needle in your arm. But it is time, 9 months after the vaccine was available, and essentially 5 months since we've had an abundance of supply, so the question of access no longer really exists, that we need to rethink our vaccine distribution strategy. We have hit a wall. It's getting a little bit better now, probably because of some of the mandates and because of fears of Delta. But we need to move. We need more. I mean, essentially, that's the answer. And so that's what the reframing of that article was, is that we talk so often about the unvaccinated and their feelings and their rights and everything. And all of a sudden, I was just sitting there writing. I was like, you know, the vaccinated have feelings, too.
That's true.
And our kids have feelings. You know, the kids that can't get vaccinated and the first responders and doctors have feelings, and the nurses who are now facing an onslaught of medical needs that are essentially voluntary at this stage. I mean, we just see the data that if you're vaccinated, you are just very much unlikely to require hospital help.
Right. I mean, we're seeing the ICUs now crowded,
yeah,
with people who chose to take that risk, and it's crowding out other people who might need surgery or other, you know, procedures that are just as serious. All right, so, well, you know, how far would you go? Should unvaccinated people wear, I don't know, a bell around their neck to alert you that they're coming? Or, you know, what do you do to people who are going to refuse no matter what?
Well, so I think, I mean, and this is where I'm also critical of the Biden administration. I think that we will look back at 2021 and the failure to have a sort of system like we have driver's licenses that just simply designates, you know, whether you are vaccinated or not. So I can imagine in 2, 3, 4 years, we'll probably get more sophisticated. But no, it's just an issue of do you have a card? Can you prove that you got vaccinated or not? And that's it. And if you can't, then Bruce Springsteen doesn't want you in his audience, right? And if you can't, then the University of California doesn't want you as a student. I mean, we now need to shift the burden from begging, which is essentially what the vaccinated are doing now in the medical community, to pretty please, right? We need to move from begging and pretty please to, okay, there's going to be consequences for this now.
Right. But when you say you've got a choice, when the choice is either get vaccinated or lose your job, to a lot of people, that's not a choice. That's a dictate.
But it's your choice. I mean, in other words, it's not the employer's choice anymore, or not the employer's requirement to allow the alternative is that you're then forcing employers who have other employees they have to care about, let alone insurance plans, let alone, you know, not being able to function if they lose too many of their employees. That burden is no longer on the employer. It's on the individual employee. So the people who talk about choice all the time, right? If my choice, we are giving you that choice.
Here's an idea, and it's from the conservative playbook, so nobody should object to this. We pass a law that says if you notice somebody who is unvaccinated and in public, you can file a lawsuit and you will get at least $10,000 if it turns out they don't have a vaccination card.
Right. That would be a twist. I am hearing that now. The reason why I and others are at this stage now isn't just because we've hit a wall in terms of vaccination, but the data and the polling do suggest that the unvaccinated, there's the core anti-vaxxers, which has been relatively the same, about 11 or 12% throughout this entire pandemic. But that the unvaccinated are what I call sort of flimsy unvaccinated. In other words, they hold a belief, but they don't hold it that strongly. Mm. And so a lot of them are polling now saying, yeah, if I was required to, I would do it. You know, a lot of them got moved by FDA approval. But basically, the polling shows that for example, that 42% of the still unvaccinated, the wait and see, would get vaccinated if you told them they could not get on airplanes. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Give them what they want, so some of it is like, we don't have enough time anymore. We've got to get the community spread under control.
Now, about your book, Security Mom.
Yes.
Is that a thing? What
so
do
it was
moms
a riff
do?
On, yeah, no. It was a riff on. So there was a, in the 2002 election, it was a term that was used to describe a suburban white woman, predominantly suburban white women, who were so fearful of the post 2001 stage that they were more likely to vote more conservative, mm-hmm. And Republican based on that. So part of it was to retake it and to basically say, you know, women can be smart about security without being paranoid, because in some ways, you know, the security mom replaced the soccer mom, right? So in some ways, it's sort of a sexist thing. And so the book, though, is a reflection of my life in homeland security and crisis management for 20 plus years now, my goodness, and the mother of three, and how a lot of those skills are very similar, that we think about risk minimization. You try to have layered defenses. All those things that we try to do as parents are actually part of an overall sort of, you know, security framing, right? I mean, I think this gets back to the pandemic, that, you know, this idea that we're going to eliminate COVID, like no one thinks that, right? So we have to just think about risk minimization, right?
So you're saying that we tend to get too paranoid? I mean, didn't that job leave you kind of paranoid?
No, it's the opposite. I mean, it's, you know, people in this field tend not to stew. Mm-hmm. You just try to move on and fix things. Our standard in homeland security and crisis management, as it is in pandemic planning, is, you know, you just try to make things less worse. And part of what, you know, pushing for shifting the burden of vaccination is we just got to make things less worse. We're not going to make them perfect. People will still be unvaccinated or sick for, you know, I don't know how long, but that is, you know, making things less worse is the job.
Well, that makes it sound more doable. Just make it less worse.
Yes.
Julia Kayyem is the chair of the Homeland Security Department at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it, Julia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Make things less worse. That's a good phrase for today. It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It is sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. Some California healthcare workers are washing away the stress of multiple COVID waves with surf therapy and showing how the rough ocean can calm the mind. CBS's Carter Evans has the story.
First-time surfers usually spend most of their time tumbling in the whitewater. But with each wipeout, these 10 Southern California healthcare workers are washing away pandemic stress.
The pressure is okay.
Nurse Daniel Shimolevsky works 12-hour shifts at Torrance Memorial Hospital.
It's been exhausting, physically and mentally. Every day after work, I catch myself thinking about work and the patients and, you know, what we could have done better.
His prescription today?
Hi, my name is Dan.
Surf therapy.
It's almost like 6 to 8 months of therapy in about 2 or 3 hours.
Therapist and surfer Kevin Souza is leading the session.
We're constantly projecting to the future what may or may not happen, and that's where anxiety lives.
And when you're paddling through a wave, there's no time for
that. You are right here, and you are right now.
The wipeouts are soon followed by smiles and cheers. And before long, these new students are starting to become surfers.
And you still got this big smile on your face.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I just got done working like 3 12-hour shifts a row.
Now you look pretty comfortable
now. Yeah, something about being out there, the waves right there, it just takes away from everything.
Turns out a turbulent ocean can calm the mind. Carter Evans, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Something about water that is incredibly healing. At the start of July, I spent about a week at the coast and just stood out there listening to the ocean. It's like natural meditation, no thinking required. a different sound. It must mean it's not G. Scott. It's our buddy Aaron Mason. Mace in your face, as he likes to call himself.
What's up, Colleen?
Hi, Aaron.
That's just my Zoom name. That's my little, you got to have some fun.
Are you filling in for Ursula or G today? Is that why you're
here? I'm filling in for G today, yes.
Okay,
yes,
wonderful.
Yes, yes, yes. So it'll
Looking
be me and Ursula.
That.
Very excited.
Right after Seattle's morning news, 9 to noon. So about an hour ago, we all stopped what we were doing and watched the trailer for the new Matrix movie, which to me dropped out of nowhere. I didn't even know this was coming.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So on the one hand, Keanu is a national treasure and we love him.
I stan Keanu, yes.
Yes, and the new Matrix is a pop cultural event. Mm-hmm. On the other, there are no new ideas in Hollywood, and we want to talk about that, too.
Yeah.
So first, what did you think of the trailer? Did it live up to the hype?
Well, okay, here's the thing. I'm very cautious. Let me set my Matrix table, if I can, for a second. I saw the first one in the theaters in 1999, I believe, and was completely blown away. Hadn't seen anything like it before. Literally, there are shots in that first Matrix movie that had never been attempted before. Its look, the plot. Halfway through the movie, I had no idea what was going on and absolutely loved it. The second two, they made a Matrix 2, Matrix 3. I'm a little thumbs down on those. Yeah, we're getting the gag face from Sully.
Sully, you can join in on this conversation, too. You don't just have to mime your disgust on our video chat.
Feel free to crack
the mic and weigh in.
But so I go into this one with a little bit of hesitancy. It's also it's written and directed by a singular Wachowski. The Wachowskis have done their entire film catalog together. And now it is just Lana. Lily is not involved.
Why?
In this one. Because after her, she says, after her transition and the death of her parents, she didn't want to go back to something in her, like revisit something that had been done. She wants to do other things. So, yeah, they're trans, the Wachowskis.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make sure I was
Good call.
Reading that correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, just kind of wanted to move forward, was in a different headspace, different direction. And so, is doing something else, basically.
Okay. All right. So you're hesitant about this because it's only one of the two who had the original idea in screenplay and all of that.
Right. And then, but the trailer gave me some hope. I'm very excited. I love a bearded, long-haired Keanu. Give me some of that John Wick style. I'm here for it.
Yes,
a lot of the original cast missing, of course, Lawrence Fishburne, the original Morpheus.
I noticed that. I thought, was this purposeful or like going back in time and so it's a young Morpheus? Or
I missed that the actor died?
This
is, I believe, the next iteration of the one, except Neo remembers his previous life this time.
Oh, interesting. That's good.
So this is the new Morpheus looking for the new The One, but The One still remembers who he is.
This is
what I'm thinking.
And I like this. I like this speculation because that's what's fun about this. The trailer that we watched this morning. Yeah, it doesn't tell you much about the plot. And that for me, like I said earlier, is one of the most fun things about these Matrix movies is just really being in for the ride, but not necessarily knowing what's happening in the moment.
I'm wondering, too, if this is, you know, how that we said, like, there's no new ideas in Hollywood. But, you know, just yesterday, the actor who was in Blue's Clues for the young, you know, millennial and Gen X generation, he came out and he just said, hey, I just wanted to touch base. And it was such like a cathartic, relaxing thing to watch as an elder millennial that I wonder if Hollywood's just trying to pacify us and soothe us because we're going through a lot right now. Why not revisit the good times of 1999 when The Matrix came out?
100%, Colleen, because we are of similar age and so are the people in Hollywood making a lot of these decisions.
Yeah.
You know, so they know what we Matrix. I love The Matrix.
And
I'm the
totally
one who gets to put the stamp
too,
on this
Aaron.
Movie.
Because the Blue's Clues thing, I was like, this was so soothing. Thank you so much for doing this for us. But then I realized later on, they're not doing this for us. They're doing it because they know we have kids now and they want them to watch Blue's Clues, which hook, line, and sinker. I was like, I can't wait to wake up my 2-year-old and have her watch Blue's Clues.
It worked. Yeah.
By the way, in my secret universe, Nick Allard and I have been having this discussion on Twitter about The Matrix again.
Ooh.
And I think that John Wick is who Neo becomes when he enters the Matrix. And that trilogy was just another trilogy, and they all fake this all out. John Wick's just in the Matrix. How else could he be so good at killing people?
Oh.
That would be really funny if that was the big ha-ha at the end. I know it's not true, but we're having a spirited discussion on Twitter about
this. Who knows, Sully? Who knows?
And now we have to wait till Christmas to see if all of these speculative ideas about the trailer come to fruition. One thing's for sure, I'm bringing back my Trinity Halloween costume.
Oh, come on. Serious?
I can rock that. Oh, yeah. I used to have super short hair. So I slicked it back. It's so easy to do. I mean,
she's
all black and glasses. Hello. But she's, I like her.
Yeah,
but
Carrie Ann
Moss.
She died. Shout
out. She died in the last one, but reinserted.
Nope. Now she's here in this one.
Hasn't seen the movies yet, and they want to catch up before they watch the new
one. You don't have to worry about two and three.
Two and three are just a joke. Are you kidding me?
All right. Thanks,
let's go
Mace.
Find
we'll
the keymaster or whatever, the gozer.
The
and now who knows what the gatekeeper, the keymaster. Jeez.
We just did all of their promotional marketing for them.
Yep. It works.
Yeah,
all right,
it
we'll
does.
Hear you, Aaron, again at 9 to noon with Ursula Roitzine. That's coming up. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you so much, guys.
We're now live to Washington, D.C. now, and CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. And, of course, the big news event today is going to be the president's announcement of new COVID requirements for federal employees. And how is this going to go down with the federal workforce? I mean, I've heard of people who are so anti-vaccine, they're just prepared to quit.
Well, it's an interesting question, Dave, and it's good, really great to talk to you and hear your voice. Look, the universe of people affected by this is in the low millions. There are about 2 million federal agency civilian employees. And additionally, perhaps a million or more federal contractors. And among them are people who work across federal agencies, not just bureaucrats who sit at desks with computers, but, you know, people like park rangers and law enforcement officers. So this applies to a segment of the society that is wide ranging. And remember, over the summer, the president already imposed a vaccine mandate for the civilian federal workforce, as well as the uniformed military, and created an exception where you could essentially get a weekly test. Each agency would determine how to perform that test, which they were essentially a testing opt-out. Aides are telling us that that testing opt-out is going away, particularly now that the FDA has formally authorized and approved the Pfizer vaccine. So, it'll be interesting to see what happens next, right? Will some federal workers who oppose this seek to get some kind of legal protection from it? Will there be particular exceptions in the order? We haven't seen it yet.
No religious exceptions either?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. That's a key question. Religious exemptions, perhaps. Maybe medical exemptions, perhaps. I don't know at this point, but it's certainly something that I'm thinking about as we follow the story today.
Now, the other story that I've been following is I see occasional headlines pop up saying, hey, the debt ceiling, we exceeded it in July, and they've been moving money around in the accounts to keep the government going, but we're now, I guess, days away from having no money in the bank. Are they going to really play this game again? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Now, are they playing the game? Yeah, the game's in play right now. Look, yesterday, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen sent a letter to Capitol Hill that said that those extraordinary measures that you were talking about, moving money around in various accounts and whatnot, those extraordinary measures will run out. She didn't say exactly when, but she said sometime in the month of October. So I asked the press secretary, Jen Psaki, yesterday, does that mean that the president is expecting some sort of action on this from Congress by the end of September? And she indicated the answer is yes, but she also said that because a firm date isn't yet known on the Treasury Secretary's part, perhaps there might be some more time than September 30th. But she said that, you know, the president certainly has the expectation that the Congress will act before the money runs out. This is an issue that has been – it's a perennial issue that comes up in Washington every few years. I remember about 10 years ago. We were talking about the prospect of, America going off the fiscal cliff and facing default, and America's credit rating was downgraded. You remember all those stories from 2011. In the end, it was resolved by a last-minute agreement. In this case, Democrats, as you know, control both houses of Congress, but, you know, it's a standalone measure. It would require 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a possible GOP filibuster. And Republicans, even though they did it three times in Donald Trump's presidency, are apparently loath to support an increase in the debt ceiling now while Joe Biden is in office. And the White House, is part of its argument, says that the debt ceiling does not respect future spending, and the president hopes and expect to spend trillions of dollars more, but it's a reflection of past spending that past Congresses have already approved.
I mean, this so even prohibits you from borrowing money, even though people want to lend it to you, which, I mean, I don't know of any other country that does this. And the last time they even got close to a default, it changed interest rates enough that the government wasted, I think, what, $80 billion having to pay higher interest rates? So, you know, if this is all in the name of saving money, what sense does it make?
Well, I think that whoever's in the minority, it seems, over the last few years has tried to use it as a way to extract some sort of concession from the majority and perhaps from the White House. So I think there are many Republicans in Congress who appreciate the actual pain that could happen in the country if we were to have the kind of situation play out that we've seen in past years. Mind you, there's also another deadline, September 30th, and that's for federal agency funding, lest we have a government shutdown. So the ball is in the Democrats' court to move these measures along, and we haven't really seen a hard and fast plan from Speaker Pelosi as to how this is going to play out over the course of the next few weeks, but certainly, you know, she's of a mind to get it done in time, as is Chuck Schumer in the Senate. The fact is, you know, this is a circumstance that, you know, or has arisen every few years. The question I put to Jen Psaki earlier this year was whether this president, this White House, believes that the 14th Amendment, in its particular clause that says the debt of the national government should not be questioned, means that this White House views the debt limit as unconstitutional itself.
Good point.
Well, so this White House is not of a mind to say so and has not been. But we're also not at crisis point yet. And the constant call from this White House has been to say that Congress should do what it has always done, which is act on a bipartisan basis to waive or raise the debt ceiling.
Yeah. One more thing. Are you worried at all about this demonstration coming up, I guess, this weekend in support of the January 6th insurrectionists?
I think it's scheduled for next weekend. Yeah, certainly it's something that everybody here in Washington is thinking about in the back of their mind or top of mind, depending on, where you are and what responsibilities you have. And, you know, federal law enforcement certainly is focused on it. There's no doubt about it. There's a suspicion or a report, and I haven't delved too deeply into it, that some of the protective fencing that was around the Capitol for many months after January 6th may wind up going back up ahead of September 18th.
Stephen Portnoy, live from Washington, D.C. Stephen, thank you.
You bet.
Joke points.
Let's go.
Traffic coach and daredevil Chris Sullivan, after being fully informed of the hazards he might face, entered the active Montlake construction site to see for himself how it's going. So how's it going?
It's going really well, and it's really neat to get out on this platform that they have built that they use to build the new eastbound lanes from basically Montlake out to the floating bridge. They're basically building a mirror of what we see on the westbound drive right now. So it was really cool. We walked through the north end of the Arboretum, which, by the way, will eventually be reclaimed and reforested there once they're finished with this project. And Washington Department of Transportation, Steve Peer was my guide. We walked up to this wooden trestle and then out over Lake Washington.
We are on a work trestle specifically built to build the eastbound lanes between the Montlake lid and the floating bridge.
It felt like an old time, just a dock you would see at a marina. I expected to see fishing boats out there if it wasn't so high over the water. It was really pleasant out there. Concrete columns coming up out of the water, surrounded by the lily pads and the milfoil. Ducks and geese swimming happily along, almost oblivious to what was being done around them. It's actually kind of a quiet time on that particular part of the project because there's spawning going by, fish spawning, and so they've kind of knocked off a little bit of the heavier work there until about October. Pierce says the design that they built this trestle on is really cutting down on noise pollution and environmental damage.
It's environmentally more friendly. The neighbors liked it better because we weren't doing these big drill shafting for the columns. So it was really an innovative approach to construction.
Now, the 520 drivers can't see what's happening along this trestle because it's blocked by the concrete from the bridge they're on. But drivers have certainly noticed those giant blue cranes. There are four of them that tower above the construction zone. They look like recognizers from the movie Tron. I know, Dave, you're old enough to remember the original movie Tron. If you can't remember what those are, Google it. But they look just like these things. Anyway, these giant cranes were built specifically to the measurements of this dock that they're using. And Pierce says they can move back and forth and carry just about anything.
Sometimes they work in pairs, sometimes they work alone. But what they do is the heavy lift over the construction. So they are just working from above instead of maybe traditionally a lot of bridges get built from below.
So it's going to take until 2024 until the new eastbound bridge connecting Montlake and the floating bridge is complete. That's going to be about the same time that they complete the 3-acre Montlake lid, and all the lanes will open there about that same time frame in 2024. So I also got to tour the lid over 520, which is somewhat just reopened to traffic. There they've move the Montlake traffic onto the lid. And what they're going to do next is they're going to move the westbound exits to Montlake and Lake Washington Boulevard onto that new lid. And then the one that's done next year, workers are going to start demolishing the old ramp that connected the exit to Lake Washington Boulevard and start taking down the old Montlake Boulevard overpass. The lid will be extended to the east and west to take up that space. Eventually, a 3-acre lid complete with a new transit center. And the state's also building a new bike and pedestrian bridge to complete the trail across the lake. So there's a lot going on there.
So no more nude diving from the ramps to nowhere?
No, the thing that's kind of funny about the ramps to nowhere right now is that they're going to keep a little bit of them, but further away from the water, just kind of as a memorial.
A memorial?
And then they're going to tear down what was the ramp that goes through the water to Foster Island there as you entered from the Arboretum, because it's too low now to reach the height of the new bridge. And then, as I said, they're going to reclaim and move everything out of that north end of the Arboretum and rebuild it back up and let it go native.
That's good.
So that whole area will kind of return to normal.
So the cranes can fly like the recognizers then, is that what you're saying?
Well, kind of. I mean, they do have giant tires. I put a picture. There's a video that Michael Simeona from our web team has put together that should be up at mynorthwest.com. You get a sense of these giant tires. They roll back and forth. They don't fly like the recognizers, but
okay.
It's the same general idea. It's the first thing I thought of when I saw them in real. I'm like, wow, those look like Tron. And then I realized I was a horrible nerd.
That's right. You can ring my This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here's Rachel Bell to explain how difficult it is for musicians to get their new music out there when there's so much old music out there.
This story is really fascinating to me. So, you know, years ago, we were always covering, everybody's listening on digital now. Musicians aren't making as much money, but apparently that's kind of old news. And the person who they focused on in this article who has a lot to say is Ryan Tedder. He is a prolific songwriter. He's written songs for Adele, Ed Sheeran, Paul McCartney, Beyonce, Taylor Swift, and the list goes on and on. And he is also, the lead singer of his own band, One Republic. So they're calling him the most consistent hit maker in the 21st century, or at least one of them. And he says that there are these new constraints of being a musician in the digital era beyond the fact that you don't make quite as much money. So one of them, he says, like you mentioned, is there is, in his words, too much music. 62,000 songs a day are uploaded to Spotify. Jeez. So, you know, you have a lot that you're competing with, but you know, if you have a big name, you think that you could break through. Not necessarily true. He says a large portion of the people that are streaming, this is a quote, they've never owned a CD. They may not listen to the radio. So when they hear David Bowie's Life on Mars, they're hearing it for the first time. He says the source of discovery is the last 70 years of music. It's all brand new right now. So you're competing with every song that has ever come out. So, you know, he puts out a hit single and he's suddenly competing with the Beatles and Fleetwood Mac and the Rolling Stones and Elton John. And statistics back them up. It says in the UK, there are only 4 new albums among the 20 bestsellers for the first half of this year. The rest is Queen, Fleetwood Mac, Elton John, ABBA, and Oasis. This is who they're competing with. So The Weeknd, who you're hearing right now, this song spent a record-breaking 89 weeks and counting in the U.S. singles chart. But this song was actually released in 2019, and it was not doing well until the song got used in a car commercial in Germany. And then it exploded, and it started getting big in Europe, and it finally made its way to the U.S. He also gives the example about his own band. One Republic released a new single called Run. And this was the new song, but they found that the song that was doing better was a song from 2013 that they put out called Counting Stars. And he couldn't figure out what was going on. And his manager said, some kid took your song. He sped it up. He put it on TikTok. And now people are going back and trying to find the song and listening to it. So he says, quote, it's a nightmare because we live in a time when track 7 off an album you released 6 years ago has a greater chance of becoming a hit than the current song you're promoting. He says it defies gravity.
Well, the music business has always been hard to predict. I mean, if you could predict what makes a hit, then every song would be a hit. And where do you find new songs? I mean, if you're telling me that there's these tens of thousands of songs on Spotify, it's like going to Netflix. How do I decide what to watch?
That's why I rewatch the same stuff all the time, because I go to Netflix, I flick around.
Yeah.
I can't find anything that looks good. And so I just watch the same things over and over again. What do you think, though? Do you think that, you know, musicians are frustrated by this, but is it more or less fair? Because, you know, the old system was really dictated by, you know, being on a big recording label, and yeah, they would put out songs on the radio, which meant a lot of people were being left out, you know? So this way, it's actually a little more natural, I guess, if people are
also more democratic, right? I mean, before the
right, so,
of the record company, and the record company would sometimes take over your group because they were focus grouping the music to see, you know, who would respond to what. It wasn't very democratic. You had to have a big machine behind you. Now, if you do something creative, first of all, you can publish it yourself. Then the second thing is getting noticed. And I guess that's sort of a crapshoot, right?
Like there was a, I don't know if it was a TikTok or something on Instagram, this guy on a skateboard who was drinking out of a bottle of Cran apple juice. He was playing a Fleetwood Mac song in that video. And that song, you know, went right up to number one again. It was released in the 70s, right? I don't know. It's kind of cool in a way. It does introduce young people to old music. I don't know. I don't think anybody would be satisfied anyway, right, by the music industry, because someone's always going to be making the money that you wish you were making. Someone else is going to get the exposure. I don't know if there's something that's fair for everybody.
You make your money now going on tour, right?
Your
music gets noticed, and then you get a contract to go on tour. And that, of course, that exhausts you. You get into drugs, have to go into rehab, and there are all sorts of complications. It just seems like it makes more sense to be good at putting up drywall than being a musician.
It does. But you know, an artist, he has to follow his heart.
Yes.
That's why we all do the art of news. Well, Dave, it is so great to talk with you. I'm so glad that you're back, even just for a little bit. I missed you.
Thank you, Rachel. Rachel Bell, everybody.
And the crowd goes wild.
And the crowd goes wild.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.